Eventually, however, after a second relocation, this time to a housing project in Manhattan, they drifted apart. Even there, rumors soon circulated that her husband was a rat. On February 28, 2003, Pipe walked into Judge Grease's courtroom. O'Malley betrayed no emotion as Pipe caught his eye. Had Pipe been wrong to trust him? He realized he'd admitted everything, and yet nothing had been promised in return. After the preliminaries, Judge Grease looked down at Pipe through his glasses. Pipe focused on a red and green tapestry behind the judge as he spoke quietly and deliberately, admitting his role as OG of sex money murder. He confessed to racketeering, violent crime with a machine gun, and selling drugs, along with the unlawful transport of firearms. The charge of kidnapping had been dropped. Baby Ainge, the instigator of the plot, had been killed on the block. And then it was over. Immediately on his return, he was moved to the special housing unit for his own safety. All contact with his co-defendants was severed. The MDC was full of men trying to stay alive while pretending they weren't snitches. Despite his new status as cooperator, Pipe still had social capital, which only increased when a magazine mentioned Pipe and the original sex money murder crew. "I didn't know you was that strong in the street," said an inmate who had read the story. He boasted about his crew on Long Island and how much money he would make on his release. But Pipe knew that he, too, was cooperating. He asked if Pipe had concerns about cooperating against the Bloods. "I wasn't loyal to no Bloods," snapped Pipe. Even O.G. Mack, the Blood founder, had been revealed as a snitch. "I was loyal to the pistol," Pipe said, although Pete had already been sentenced by the time Pipe cooperated, and he wouldn't have to sit on him in court. "That's who I grew up with, started a gang with, and that's who my loyalty is to. As far as people on my case, I don't know these dudes, man." Pipe paused. "I got a clean conscience. Any of them Blood dudes try to hurt me or jump out the window to hurt any of mine's, then they gonna have a problem." O'Malley and La Barbera offered him the protective custody program, telling him that several others had taken advantage of it. Pipe refused. "I may be a cooperator," he said, "but I'm still a gangster. I ain't running and hiding from no one." 8. 5K. In the middle of their pinochle game, Sammy Gravano laid down his cards to offer Shug some advice. The old-time mafia hitman had sent 19 men to the grave. Now he was shriveled and pink, with limpid saucer eyes, the result of plastic surgery to evade the $2 million contract on his head after putting John Gotti, the boss of bosses, and numerous other mobsters away. Shug thought he looked like an alien. The two had grown close while incarcerated in the MCC. They worked out together and shared books. Gravano had served only 5 years for his murders, but had now been convicted of selling ecstasy and awaited sentencing. Shug had confided to him his deep unease at becoming a snitch. "No matter what you do in this world," Sammy said, "if you can get up and look at yourself in the mirror and tell yourself you love you, that's all that matters." On May 14, 2003, Shug was led into the Honorable John Martin's courtroom, where he stole a glance at his old friend Bimo, sitting in a sober gray suit. Both he and Bimo, as Pete had done, were wearing glasses, although neither of them had problems with their eyesight. Between the defense lawyers sat federal marshals in suits, no badges or guns, nothing to suggest to the jury that the accused was dangerous. Shug had fought to hold out for Bimo, but the lies had crumbled in the face of O'Malley and La Barbera's questioning. He looked across the packed courtroom and saw O'Malley toward the back of the public gallery, checking him out. Up until now, all his confessions had been in private with O'Malley and La Barbera, but as soon as he opened his mouth in court, his new status as a cooperator would be public. He felt exposed and lonely. He turned to O'Malley, standing in relief against the wood paneling, but the investigator just stared ahead placidly. The prosecutor took Shug through his crimes in Springfield, the shootouts against E.T. Larry, and the eventual murder of Chiron Little. Shug told the story of his kidnapping and pistol whipping. He looked at the jury, believing that he could elicit their sympathy if he told the story well. If there was one incident that made him as violent as he was, he would say it was being held in an elevator in the projects at gunpoint, blood leaking down his face, convinced he was going to die. Shug's eyes kept drifting toward an Asian woman on the jury who regarded his testimony dispassionately, which unsettled him. He admitted killing Twin on Rolock's orders, explained the conversation he had had with BMO about the murder of a kid named Joe Dix. A defense lawyer, Larry Krantz, noted that Shug had lied to federal agents, and that after he had signed documents saying he would commit no more crimes while on probation, he had murdered Twin. The lawyer pressed him on his motives for cooperating. "Did you decide at that point to become a cooperating witness because you had a change of heart, seen the error of your ways and wanted to unburden yourself for what you had done?" "No," said Shug. Throughout, no matter how uncomfortable it got, Shug was direct and honest, often when it wasn't in his own best interest. O'Malley was impressed. Pipe followed Shug a day later. He'd heard rumors that Baby J, now also cooperating as the star witness in BMO's trial, had offered to pay for BMO's appeal. When Pipe reached the stand, BMO smiled slightly and shook his head. Pipe assumed that he was intimating that he knew how the federal game was played. He thought that BMO understood that he was just taking a shot at freedom, as BMO might have done in his position. The prosecutor described Pipe's double dealing with the FBI, then ran through his crimes. "We played by the rules of sex money murder," said Pipe. As he continued to offer testimony, he caught sight of a sex money murder member from Castle Hill in the back of the courtroom alongside a well-dressed man in a white suit. The SMM man kept standing up, shooting caustic glances at Pipe as he testified. Just before recess for lunch, O'Malley, sitting in the back, saw the SMM gangster, tapped him on the shoulder, and asked to speak to him outside. There he discovered that he was on parole and in violation by being in court to consort with felons. O'Malley got him locked up shortly thereafter. Meanwhile, Pipe was returned to a special holding cell for cooperators. It was a comfortless place, without even a window, so that no one could see in. After lunch, a marshal opened the cage and Pipe went up in the elevator. But there'd been a mix-up. As the elevator door slid open, Pipe came face to face with BMO. Fearing that the two men would try to kill each other, the marshals jumped between them. "What are you doing?" BMO said to one of the marshals. "That's my man." Pipe added, "Sup, Mo?" They pounded each other on the back. "I see you inside," said BMO. "I love you, nigga." Giving testimony on the stand was a lonely experience. The defense lawyer, Larry Krantz, goaded Pipe, and he barely resisted an urge to jump up and punch him in the face. "I told you in opening that you would see a parade of criminals the likes of which are almost unbelievable," said Krantz in summing up. "And I submit that that is exactly what you saw here, a parade of individuals with no moral center, no moral compass whatsoever, a parade of individuals who probably, based on what you heard on the witness stand, could be labeled pathological liars, sociopaths." He continued, "These are murderers, liars, con artists. These are people who have devoted their life to lying and criminality. They are trying to spare their own life. Without cooperation, they will die in prison." When the jury took a second day to deliberate, O'Malley fretted that SMM had gotten to one of the jurors. But the jury finally returned a guilty verdict on the most serious of the charges. In September 2003, BMO was sentenced to 50 years with no parole. As the jury filed out, they all avoided eye contact with BMO. After any guilty verdict, The marshals moved prisoners swiftly out of the courthouse because the transfer after sentencing would be the most likely moment for an escape attempt. News of BMO's conviction spread throughout the MDC and the MCC with startling speed, and O'Malley knew that more potential cooperators would be coming in the next few days. BMO's conviction would send a strong message. He waited for attorney phone calls on Monday, and they came. By May 2003, Chantal had stopped coming to see Pipe, and he was now completely alone. In August, when Nutt stood trial for killing Tony Morton, Pipe was again called to the stand. La Barbera had left on maternity leave. A new prosecutor, Helen Cantwell, a Harvard graduate, stepped in. She approached cooperators with exactitude and little warmth. For Pipe, her approach and La Barbera's contrasted sharply. She found Pipe particularly arrogant. "I'm not here to be your buddy," she said. Pipe dreaded the sessions with her because if he was caught leaving anything out, even unintentionally, she'd rip up his agreement and he'd be left with his guilty pleas and a life sentence. In court, Cantwell initiated the government's case with the testimony from a couple Nutt had robbed in the projects. The following day, Pipe testified, along with B. Love and several others. On his way to court, he crossed paths with Nutt himself. "You a fucking rat," Nutt said. "You're going to get your head popped off. And your fiancée? She's going to get her head popped off, too. The government can't protect you forever." Nutt was now claiming to be the new OG of sex money murder. "You can be the new OG," said Pipe with a shrug. "I'm happy for you." On August 16, 2003, the jury found Nutt guilty of RICO conspiracy and murder. He was sentenced to life plus 5 years. The danger of retribution for snitching was now omnipresent. Some saw cooperators as traitors who deserved a summary death sentence. On a Tuesday in June 2004, Pipe was trying to relax in his cell on the ninth floor of the Shoe in the MDC, where he'd been moved for a violation. A familiar figure kicked his cell door. Pipe hadn't seen Mac 11 for 10 years or more. He had a tattoo of sex money murder on his arm, and he wore a red do-rag to signify his blood membership. Pipe remembered him as a boy who used to run errands to the store for him and other senior members of SMM to win favor, all before he helped Suge and the others murder Twin and E-Man. Mac 11 had never relinquished the gangster creed and refused to cooperate. He eventually pleaded guilty a few weeks after Pete and was sentenced to 30 years for his role in the Thanksgiving Day shootings. He'd returned to the cell block after being sentenced and set fire to the mattress in his cell and assaulted the guards who came rushing in to douse the flames. Pipe and Mac chatted briefly. The following day, Mac 11 asked Pipe to join him for recreation, which he did. Normally, gang members, particularly those cooperating against one another, were segregated, but as the two men weren't on each other's case, the guard had no instructions to keep them apart. Mac 11 explained that if he didn't attack Pipe as food for snitching against Nutt, he himself would become food for the Bloods. He was only going to stay his hand, he said, because Pipe had the feds behind him. The two drifted apart. Back in his cell, Mac 11 slammed his fist into his palm and made choking gestures as he retold the story of his meeting with Pipe to his cellmate, Albert Burgos, a member of the Westchester Avenue crew in the Bronx. Burgos suggested a quid pro quo. Mac 11 would attack the cooperator on Burgos's case, while Burgos would attack Pipe in return. A couple of days later, a guard led Pipe to the cage containing Mac 11 and three other men. Pipe pulled back, sensing a setup. "What?" sneered the guard. "I thought you was a gangster, and you scared?" Pipe told the guard to put him in. Mac 11 greeted him with a smile. The guard asked Pipe to walk backward and to feed his hands through the slot. As he did so, Pipe saw a flash from the other side of the cage. Frantically, he tried to free his hands from the guard's grip, but it was too late. Burgos's right hand crashed into his jaw, breaking it in several places. The guard let go of Pipe's hands, unlocked the door, and dragged him out.
Uncuff me and put me back in there, Pipe screamed.
He snarled at Burgos. I'm going to see you. Do you know who I am? You ain't going nowhere in this building now. You a dead man. Pipe was taken back to his cell. The guards ignored his requests for medical attention and instead tossed him some Tylenol. The pain worsened. At mealtime, he couldn't open his jaw to eat. Over the next few days, he sucked on potato chips until they were soggy, the salt stinging his mouth, before swallowing. In the end, he took milk through a straw. Pipe suspected that the guard had a blood affiliation or had been paid. He advanced this theory when Mac 11 was moved up to his tier in the shoe. Pipe heard him shout to Burgos, "What up, son?"
"It is what it is."
Mac 11's deep laughs reverberated down the corridor.
"Yeah, you know."
The pain grew worse as infection set in. Eventually, he was allowed a hospital visit where a surgeon fixed his jaw with a titanium plate and screws, then wired it shut. Although the prison medical team removed the wires after 4 weeks, almost 2 more months went by before they took Pipe back to the oral surgeon to remove some braces. By that time, his jaw had healed out of alignment so that his mouth couldn't open straight, and the surgeon told him that to fix it would require re-breaking and resetting his jaw. X went to trial in June 2005. Shug had taken a personal dislike to X and resented his rapid rise through SMM. Shug deplored having to testify against BMO, a childhood friend, but X was another matter. The prosecutor asked Shug why he was cooperating. He said he didn't want to spend the rest of his life in jail, then added, "Another reason was that I started to see there was no loyalty and trust in the organization that I was in. Too many lies, people deceiving one another." Though he'd had Pete in mind when he said it, he declared his love for his leader only a few minutes later in testimony. "He was a good friend of mine, and he's the one that always had my back growing up. He was always there for me, any problem I had, any fights. We grew up together, fighting, jumping people. So I could always count on him to be there for me. I was the same with him." After a 3-week trial, X was convicted on July 8, 2005, of attempted murder and racketeering. He later received a life sentence along with Elijah Williams, his brother, and Michael Torres, Williams's son. As Pipe's sentencing approached, he spiraled into depression and loneliness, doing as many as 1,500 push-ups a day to ease the boredom while facing a future tarred as a cooperator. Meanwhile, on the outside, Pete was being deified. In 2002, Nas released God's Son, and in the first line of the opening song, Get Down, he referred to New York streets where killers will walk like Pistol Pete. On January 25, 2005, Pipe stood once more in Judge Grease's court, the last case of the day. The familiar figure of O'Malley stood witness once more to another defining point in Pipe's life. Stephanie Plowman stood at Pipe's side. The pair had grown close and, in a sense, become like a brother and sister. Plowman had come to respect him, quite unlike the business-only relationship she had with her other clients. She sensed his humanity, despite his acts. And, unlike other clients, he never made her feel threatened or blamed her for not helping him. He took it all upon himself. La Barbera had written a stunning 5K letter because she believed that if given the chance, Pipe could begin a new life. O'Malley was familiar by now with the subtleties, the inconsistencies, and sometimes the unfairness of the cooperating agreements, and knew that not everyone received favor from the judge for their assistance. Plowman was hoping that La Barbera's 5K letter about Pipe's cooperation, which had put 20 people away, would push the judge toward leniency. Pipe looked out of the court's 26th-floor windows. It was like peering out of an airplane window at the city below. He stood up and admitted he wasn't happy about his crimes. He was young when he started. He had 2 addicts for parents, one of them languished in prison for most of his childhood. "This was the only life I knew," he said. "I thought it was the best way to take care of my wife and my family.
I realize now it wasn't the right way to do things. The judge nodded impassively. Pipe panicked inside but pressed on. I want to apologize to anyone in their families that I hurt, and I want to apologize for anyone I was affiliated with. I wouldn't wish it on anyone to lose a loved one. Time in the courtroom slowed as Pipe clung to the judge's response. I really like your speech, Judge Grisa said. I'm going to hold you to everything you said. I'm letting you go to make the changes in your life you want to make. The judge reminded him that if he appeared in court again, there won't be any mercy. Judge Grisa freed Pipe with time served. Pipe didn't understand what had happened at first. He looked at Plowman. She grinned. Then he understood. He subdued the urge to sweep her up in his arms. She suppressed the impulse to hug him. Sometime in the early evening, he stood on the swirling and noisy lower Manhattan street outside the court, looking out at the fast-moving city, office workers surging past him on their way home. Pipe wore the MDC shoe uniform of tight blue pants, a form-fitting jailhouse shirt, and black kung fu slippers. Plowman asked him where he planned to go. He said he'd go to Chantal's apartment in Manhattan. Are you out of your mind? She said. There's a price tag on your head now. Pipe shrugged it off, just pleased to be free. An FBI agent escorted him to a hotel where they could begin to plan his transition to the outside world. Before they checked in, the FBI agent suggested they stop at Duane Reade to get a toothbrush and some other essentials. At the counter, Pipe asked for a packet of Newport menthols. Outside, on the bustling sidewalk near Madison Square Garden, the noise of rush-hour traffic filling his senses, he ripped off the packaging, tugged a cigarette out of the box, lit it, and took a deep drag. He was swept up in dizziness. He staggered happily down the sidewalk, bracing himself now and then on a street sign. 9. Exile. Pipe's faltering steps in the free world took him to a cheap and modest room in Queens. He had never held a job. He applied for cleaning positions, doing maintenance, using the skills he had learned in prison. Each time he reported his criminal and felony record, he got rejected. Frustrated, he applied for a job as a janitor at the Reebok Sports Club gym on Columbus and 67th in Manhattan, this time leaving the criminal history line blank. He got the job. For $8.50 an hour from 11 p.m. to 5 a.m., the OG scoured the floors and wiped yuppie sweat off the walls of the gym. He made $207 a week, enough to pay for a day's worth of cognac in his old life. In the early hours of Saturday morning, people were just leaving the clubs. At the end of his shift, as he trudged home, he caught sight of one or two gangsters still in the game, dawn's watery light hitting the chrome rims on a Mercedes while they drove one-handed, ball caps cocked to the side, bass pounding from inside their leather-lined cabin as they swept past him on his lone walk to the subway. After a few months, he moved in to share his elder sister Annette's apartment. Pipe's street legend still flourished. Smoking a cigarette outside one day, he ran into two bloods. "Sup, Five, where you from?" one of the men asked, indicating that he and his friends suspected he might be blood by the way he carried himself. The Five was a reference to the five-pointed star and crown of the Bloods. "Soundview," Pipe answered. The man went on to brag about the night he had spent in the company of the Sex Money Murder crew, including Lead Pipe hisself. Pipe nodded along with fake humility. They were lying. He thought, these chumps don't even know who I am. In August 2005, Pipe got a call from a friend telling him to search YouTube for a song called Tattleteller by Tony Yayo, a rapper with 50 Cent's G-Unit. The song began with a 70s soul-funk vibe and then the lines, "Pipe on death row, they told on Pete. They the reason that Pistol ain't on the street." Pipe's gorge rose. He had never cooperated against Pete. He had remained loyal to his friend. These rappers had no idea about any of this. They had no idea how sex, money, murder had deteriorated, how all around him loyalties had crumbled, and how Pete had allowed his jealousy to dictate his orders. The betrayal was Pete's, and the whole crew had turned against one another when Pete went down. Moreover, Pipe had cooperated a year or so after Pete had been convicted and wasn't even on his old friend's case. The anti-snitch message had gone wide in inner-city communities across the country. A 108-minute video entitled Stop Fucking Snitching Volume 1, produced by the Treetop Piru Bloods in Baltimore, became a national sensation. Stop Fucking Snitching t-shirts were made up. Every few weeks, O'Malley called to see how Pipe was doing. He wanted Pipe to succeed, and above all, he wanted him to know that he wasn't alone. Lost as he was, Pipe latched onto O'Malley and drew on their relationship for reassurance as he faced his new life. Pipe once again turned to Chantal. They took up where they left off, and soon Chantal was pregnant with his son. The news startled him, and he was forced to consider how he could support a child on his minimum wage. One possible solution came when he ran into a couple of bloods who lived in the apartment below his sister, one of whom was making a fortune selling ecstasy. The blood said he could offer Pipe the chance of buying pills at $2 to $3. He was selling them in clubs in Virginia Beach for $40 each. With a small investment of $1,000, Pipe could make as much as $20,000. Or if he could wholesale the pills in Virginia Beach to a major player for $15 or so, he could offload all the risk. Pipe said he would think about it. "For you, big homie, I give an even bigger discount," the blood promised him. That night, Pipe lay in bed, turning the proposition over in his mind. The deal would liberate him from scrubbing floors, put him back in a decent car, and perhaps offer a route out of poverty. Flipping the first load of ecstasy would be enough to make a down payment on a kilo of cocaine or heroin. But then, at some point, he knew, the violence would start. He'd have to kill someone, or at least attempt it, to take over a block and show he could not be robbed. And he'd never stop until he was caught or dead. Then Pipe switched focus, letting in a new sensation, a tenderness for his unborn son. He recalled what it was like growing up with an absent father in prison. He thought of O'Malley, how afraid he was to let the old man down. The next morning he told the blood he wasn't interested. Life continued to pulse at a low ebb. His relationship with Chantal disintegrated despite impending fatherhood. Pipe wasn't sure what he felt anymore. He wrestled with his emotions. Sometimes he hated Chantal, and other times he loved her. He resented how she had abandoned him in prison when his fate was unclear. They'd been through too much, their relationship born out of the chaos of Soundview. When his relationship with Chantal finally ended, Pipe took up with another woman, Erica, a friend of his sister's he had met in New York. In 2005, he quit his gym job and moved into the Virginia home she shared with her baby and her baby's father, who was in the U.S. Navy. The sailor lived in the spare room, often supporting Pipe and Erica financially. But when that support dried up, Pipe had no choice but to pawn the last two remnants of his life as OG. Two cherished $800 Averex leather jackets given to him by the rapper Lord Tariq. He got $60 for each, and what he had lost in status and prestige hit home. The money lasted only a few days, after which Erica and Pipe were panhandling for spare change outside the Big K supermarket. Then the couple had a fight at the house, and the sailor got involved, threatening Pipe with a kitchen knife. Pipe phoned O'Malley, saying he was afraid he was going to hurt the man. O'Malley called the police, who sent two officers, and got Pipe out of harm's way. Then O'Malley booked him a plane ticket back to New York. No one held out much hope for leniency at Shug's sentencing with Judge Cederbaum, scheduled for January 31, 2006. Despite Shug's substantial cooperation, O'Malley expected 20 years minimum for the murder of Twin. Shug had met with the WITSEC staff a few days earlier. Although it was unlikely he would be freed with time served, they discussed Phase 2 of the Witness Protection Program,
life on the outside after release. In these cases, the marshal whisked the free man away to an unknown location where he was given a new name and social security number. He was not permitted contact with any family members or friends, or even the investigator with whom he had worked, in Shug's case O'Malley. A violation of any of these conditions brought immediate expulsion from the program. At the hearing, Judge Cederbaum credited Shug for cooperating with the government. "I really hope that it does signify that you have a new outlook on life," she said. Shug replied that he had learned from his mistakes. "And hopefully I'll be able to fit back into society," he said, "and I hope I can give back to others." Cederbaum asked him for thoughts on his future. "It's like I was in a coma," said Shug, "and now I'm out of a coma and I have a new life." Cederbaum's remarks suggested that she saw Shug's problems as a result of a blind loyalty to bad characters. She advised him to stay away from bad companions. "Of course," Shug said. "I learned in my career planning class that the company you keep determines your outlook on things, your decision-making." "Well, it really shouldn't as you become a man," she replied, "but it certainly doesn't help to be surrounded by people who have different aims than yours. And in your case in particular, when you were influenced by a group, it's very important that you stay away from such groups." The judge gave him time served, almost 8 years at that point, and 5 years of supervised release. She ordered that he make good on financial compensation to his victims. "I heard some of those victims in this courtroom, the mothers of young men who were killed," Cederbaum said, "and it was pretty chilling." Shug almost broke down in tears. O'Malley made his way up to Shug at the defense tables. "I'm bugged out, J.O., Shug said. "I'm leaving today? Oh, shit." But when he learned that he'd have to spend an extra 30 days in WITSEC as things were prepared before his release into Phase 2, he instantly opted out of the program. Now that he had been freed, he didn't want to spend a second longer than he had to in jail. He was told that once he made the decision to leave the program, he would not be allowed back in. But Shug, true to his nature, didn't think about any of that. He thought about getting laid and smoking a joint. Life was lived by the minute, his decisions guided by what made the most sense in the moment. O'Malley called him to his office and said that it would be better for everyone if he left New York. Shug suggested Springfield. The office arranged for his supervised release to be handled in Worcester, Massachusetts. O'Malley had some parting words. "I don't want to see you kill anyone," he said, "or for anyone to put a bullet in you. And I don't want to see you get caught selling drugs again." Shug swore he was going to start anew. O'Malley worried about his cooperators and the death sentence they lived under when they were released. Any blood looking to make a reputation could make a murder attempt on a cooperator, now food, for instant status. That night, Shug went directly to Queens, where he spent the night with an old flame. The following day, he broke his promise to O'Malley and caught a cab to Soundview. He wanted to feel Soundview soil under his feet just once more. He hadn't seen his grandmother for years. He slipped into his old building and knocked on his door. Miss Julia, now 81, looked frail, but welcomed him. They sat in the living room, making small talk. Shug settled into the old feeling of belonging. After a while, Miss Julia's tone turned solemn and reflective. "There ain't nothing but trouble over here," she rasped. "Stay away from Soundview." After a couple of hours, Shug said goodbye and climbed into a taxi outside. He asked the driver to make a detour through Cozy Corner. It looked altogether cleaner than he remembered. The young hustlers there didn't recognize him, nor he them. He passed through quickly. He was a rat now and no longer welcome. He ordered the cab driver to take him away. Shug made it north to Springfield, where he still had the remnants of a family. The mother of his son took him in, and Shug saw his child for the first time since age 4 when Shug had gone into prison, and now a teenager at 13. For a few weeks, Shug tried to be a father. He drove his son to his basketball games at middle school. But over time, he drifted back to old friends, some of whom still had one foot in the drug game. One of them ran a car lot and got him a battered Lincoln. Shug began making short trips to New York and took up with the woman in Queens. He learned how to use Facebook, which allowed him to track what people in Soundview were saying about the rats. Many said that Shug should have shared Pete's fate, that he shouldn't have been released with such a light sentence when Pete was locked away for good. He felt himself receding into the purgatorial margins of society, all his rank and power gone. Shug felt it was unfair and recalled others who had cooperated with prosecutors against the killers of Fat Mike, for example, but who had been welcomed back into the fold of sex money murder. In the complex swirl of emotions, he suppressed some vague sense of survivor's self-reproach. Eventually, on a drive down to New York, Shug took a call from Pipe. They complained bitterly about one particularly critical Facebook comment. Shug decided to set the record straight. In Queens, he picked up his girlfriend and her brother. The brother brought a gun and volunteered to take the charge if they were caught. Shug was on supervised release, and any infraction could send him back to prison. He drove them all into Soundview under cover of night. They circled the horseshoe a few times before they spotted the man. "Yo, let me see the hammer," said Shug to the girl's brother in the back seat. He passed the gun forward out of the darkness. Shug rolled up beside the man on the sidewalk. "Yo!" Shug shouted, rolling down the window as he slowed the car. "Let me talk to you real quick." The man moved to the driver's side window. "Oh, you Shug, ain't you?" he asked before recoiling in horror at the gun nestling in Shug's lap in the murky interior of the car. "Let me ask you something, man," Shug said. "You got a problem with Pipe?" The guy backed off. Shug pressed him. "Don't have me come out of my character, man, and have to come over here." When he saw the man understood, Shug drove off. Pipe called Shug as he neared Springfield a couple of hours later. Everyone in Soundview was talking about his appearance. Shug returned to Soundview again a few months later to avenge more disrespects. He made threats and left, but this time, just as he was leaving, his cell phone rang. It was John O'Malley. "I don't want you guys down there," he growled. "You don't have anything to prove. Just stay away." Shug was startled at how close O'Malley was to the street. Shug took up with Gina, his ex-girlfriend in Springfield, who gave him a home and offered to help him make a fresh start, driving him to meetings with his parole officer in Worcester. He briefly got a job selling vacuum cleaners, but he spent his evenings at a strip club, blowing money and returning home at 5 a.m., smelling of cheap vanilla perfume. By August, his relationship had crumbled when his cheating was revealed and a woman called Gina at 5 a.m., saying she could keep him. Miss Julia passed away in September 2006. Shug tattooed "Julia R.I.P." on his neck and "Mama Forgive Me" on his left arm. Whatever strength he had in rehabilitation deserted him. In November, he got caught by the police in a stolen Buick Skylark. When police officers tried to cuff him, he twisted free and sprinted off. Scaling a fence, he mule-kicked a policeman before being dragged off and handcuffed. Once more, Shug, now 32, was locked up. Shug's and Pipe's narratives began to diverge sharply. Pipe had been the opportunist who had sought financial gain through gang life. But Shug, who had structured his whole identity around the code of the crew, couldn't let go of the street. They bickered. Shug derided Pipe for wearing a wire. Pipe criticized Shug for telling on Pete. In February 2006, Pipe held Chantal's hand as she delivered their son by cesarean section. Their relationship had collapsed, but childbirth brought them momentarily closer. Pipe experienced the first stirrings of parental love and responsibility. Despite living with another woman, he lavished care on his firstborn and tried to make sure he wanted for nothing. In June 2006, in breach of his unique confinement conditions, Pistol Pete put out a self-published book, Trigger. He had started a manuscript in the Charlotte jail in 1997 and written the book in longhand in the ADX. The protagonist of his Bildungsroman, Taiwan, a young hustler from Soundview, has an ambitious dream. New York would be introduced to one of the youngest, most feared drug kingpins in the city's history, he wrote. He referenced the hustler's dream of untold riches and told how Taiwan attended parties with P. Diddy, Tyra Banks, and Tupac and Biggie Smalls. Pete's murders were thinly disguised, as was the pleasure he had taken in killing. Without any hesitation, Taiwan squeezed off 5 shots from his .45. He walked down the steps and stood directly over Slim's body and fired 2 more shots at point-blank range into Slim's head, killing him instantly. At that moment, an instant feeling of satisfaction and security flowed through his veins. The adrenaline rush that he heard others talk about feeling after taking a life was now his own boost of energy, and just like Shamley, Kane, and everybody else like them, Ty enjoyed what he felt. Just like a person inhaling the powerful gray smoke out of a crack pipe for the first time, little did he know, he was already addicted to the feel of the kill. In the end, Taiwan, head of money and murder, makes the top of the FBI's most wanted list, chased by an agent, McNally, only to be double-crossed by one of the biggest rats in New York City history, a member of his own crew. The damage that this one man would be responsible for would affect families for generations. Taiwan dies in a blaze of bullets, a martyr to the cause of drug dealing, increasing money stacks, luxury cars, and staying true to the game. Pete's book concluded, "In death, the legend of Taiwan Riley had been solidified. Books and magazine articles were written about him, and straight-to-DVD movies were made. He had been immortalized in rap songs, and people who had never been in the same room with him now proudly wave shirts with his likeness printed on them. Gangsters and hustlers everywhere, both young and old, reverently tell stories about his life." Shug heard about the book, but never read it. Although he still venerated Pete and the gangster life he described in his book, the reality of catching his first body had created infinitely more problems for Shug than it solved, and was far from glamorous. It was a bitter paradox that he'd murdered to prove his fealty, in the same way that as a boy he had fought for acceptance and a greater sense of belonging in the neighborhood. But now, with this ultimate act of allegiance, he had been exiled from Soundview, more lonely and isolated than ever. In April 2007, police were called to a dispute Shug was having with a girlfriend in Springfield. He'd been standing outside the apartment, according to a witness, shouting at the woman inside, "You better get the fuck out of here, 'cause I'm gonna start fucking shooting." The witness said that Shug had acted as if he had a gun concealed under his hoodie. Although no gun was recovered, he was charged with possession of a firearm without a license, assault with a dangerous weapon, and domestic assault. The arrest report detailed the 20 street aliases he used. Shug was taken into custody by the U.S. Marshals and returned to the Southern District of New York for breach of his supervised release. After only 18 months, Shug appeared in court once again in front of Judge Cederbaum. In court once again for Shug, O'Malley's severe expression needed no translation. He felt that Shug had spat in the face of everyone who'd tried to help him. La Barbera, who knew Shug had never really understood why he might need to change, was deeply upset he had squandered his chance. Cederbaum went through some formal motions, and then, to everyone's disbelief, let Shug go free without charge. Further, she waived the terms of his supervised release. O'Malley surmised that Cederbaum had become exasperated and just wanted to forego any responsibility for him. Shug gave O'Malley a fuck-you sneer and skipped out of court. He'd beaten the feds once more. He felt invincible. He was subsequently arrested on a domestic assault in Vermont, followed by a DUI. Now unwelcome in yet another state, he returned to Springfield, where he was arrested again on a September evening in 2008. At around 8:30 p.m., police officers heard gunshots and stopped a Camry that had been shot at several times by a man on a bicycle.
Shug was found in the car with a pit bull on the back seat and 11 bags of heroin packaged with rice to keep it fresh before it was sold. Pleading guilty, he skipped again with time served. He was the luckiest felon O'Malley knew, somehow always able to use guile, a quick mouth, and a lifetime spent learning how to manipulate the system to get back on the street. He wandered back to New York, where he linked up with Pipe, then living with Annette. Pipe knew enough about Shug to know he was a danger to her, but she was soon pregnant with Shug's second son. He moved in with her and managed to land a job at MTV in shipping and receiving. He liked the steady money, but grew bored. So he left and went on welfare, smoking weed most days to ease his agitation. Shug was a lost soul, a soldier without a general to take orders from or an army to fight for. He was still prone to violence and was arrested for assaulting Annette. When arguments erupted, she called him a rat publicly, even though O'Malley had told her not to use that phrase in the housing projects. It was too dangerous. They moved around the city. O'Malley worried that Shug would draw Pipe back into the old life. He told Pipe to stay away, but Pipe was now trying to convince Shug to go straight. "When you cooperated, all that gangster shit was finished," Pipe said. "The code's over. You got a new code now. You ain't a gangster no more." But Sugar Shaft had no interest in becoming Sean again. Redemption wasn't easy for Pipe. He posted his resume on Craigslist. A man contacted him, saying he needed someone to mail out electronics in prepaid packages. It seemed like a sinecure, and Pipe signed on. GPS devices for airplanes and other items arrived at his apartment with prepaid packaging. Pipe mailed them out to assigned addresses. Within a few weeks, his parole officer, flanked by a heavily armed detachment of Connecticut State Police and gang squad detectives, burst into his apartment. Pipe had unwittingly gotten himself involved in fencing stolen goods. After an investigation, he was vindicated. Once more, he went in search of work. He and Erica decided to get married. They said their vows in jeans and T-shirts at a church in the Bronx, with Roe as best man. When Pipe thought out loud that he might return to the streets, Erica held firm. "I didn't marry a street person," she said. Through Erica's uncle, Pipe managed to land a job at a hospital in Queens doing maintenance work for $15 an hour. When Erica gave birth to a daughter, Pipe's attraction to the streets vanished. He doted on her and vowed he would never return to prison and leave her without a father to protect her. Yet his status as a cooperator affected his children even years later. Sometimes his son and Chantal went back to visit his grandparents in Soundview. The kids teased him that his father was a rat. People continued to threaten Pipe over social media. In the summer of 2013, the hospital laid him off. The electricity in their home was shut off. Pipe's car was repossessed, and he had to pay several $100 to get it back before it was repossessed yet again. Then, toward the end of that summer, he received a call from the Iron Workers Union offering him an apprenticeship. A while back, he'd filled out some forms and been rejected, but told his application would stay on file. The man on the phone warned him that the work would be challenging and that he would have to attend night school 3 times a week after working a full day. He explained the hourly wage and how it would rise each year. Pipe spun the numbers in his head just as he had with cocaine consignments. He might be able to buy a home, his dream, within 5 years. He awoke at 3:45 a.m. and walked a hilly mile and a half in a New England city to the train station. He worked a full day. "I love money," he told his co-workers. Pipe then went to night school after work. Sometimes he got only 3 hours of sleep. Trudging through knee-deep snow, he thought of Pistol Pete, his whole world a concrete cell without a window. He missed his old friend, still loved him. Sometimes when Pipe heard Tupac now, he was transported back to playing basketball in Soundview Park on a sweet summer's night, Pete always with that joyous grin as he dribbled and made jump shots, even though he wondered if Pete might have killed him, too, if the feds hadn't intervened.
Pipe contemplated what they would say if they saw each other again. Word reached the street that Pete had been nearly a model prisoner in the ADX. In his first 2 years in solitary, he took closed-circuit TV courses in philosophy, political theory, and economics. By 2006, he had racked up numerous hours of classical mythology, the joy of science, and the history of ancient Rome. He'd completed an anger management course. His lawyers argued that he was well on the way to rehabilitation and ready to enter the general population. The original 18-month review of his solitary confinement conditions had long expired, but still he was kept isolated. The government continues to argue that Rolock is a danger, notably because of the reverence he inspires among East Coast bloods, many of whom may do his bidding unquestioningly. Sometime in his sentencing, he was restricted from contacting his father. We have concerns that he may enlist his father to have his father's associates do harm to the witnesses and/or their families, wrote a prosecutor. On the Bronx streets, Pistol Pete's legend still persists, even though the other Bronx crews of his era are long forgotten. Around 2004, Forselli returned to the Bronx to visit his wife's family. His mother-in-law showed him a T-shirt she'd bought in a neighborhood store for her grandson. It read, "Free Pistol Pete." Rolock's viral legacy spread down the eastern seaboard. The first generation of sex money murder was nearly eradicated, but permutations of it survive to this day. In May 2014, three SMM members broke into a Decatur, Georgia home and shot three women and a 9-month-old boy taking cover in the bathtub. Tanika Smith tried to protect her son, Ken Darius Edwards, Jr., as 9 bullets tore into her. He was killed, while she and another woman survived. Their killing had been ordered by O.G. Kenneth Jackson, incarcerated in Autry State Prison in retaliation for their brother Azlushla's unauthorized killing of a fellow SMM member he believed was a snitch. Investigators discovered that Jackson had looked for guidance to Mac 11, who had become an exalted ranking blood leader in the prison system. Jackson, 3 other gang members, and a female accomplice were indicted by a grand jury in May 2016 and faced trial. Similar scenes play out in the sex money murders' new strongholds in Kingston, New York, and Newark, New Jersey, where SMM's influence and ideology have spread. Younger members use the term Peter Roll as shorthand for murder, although they don't know the provenance of the phrase. On a sultry day in the summer of 2016, Pipe stood on the 32nd floor of 3 World Trade Center, a soaring 1,000-foot monolith under construction. He had completed 3 years of night school and an apprenticeship to become a journeyman with a rigging supervisor qualification. He had saved up enough to take out a mortgage on a house and sent his daughter to a private school so she could have a different life than his. He hung, suspended, swinging back and forth like Spider-Man from the soaring battleship-gray supports that surged toward the sky, high above the dizzying drop to the city below. He was profiled against the 2 cascading waterfalls that marked where the old towers were before 9/11. He had a thick black beard now, and his forearms were corded with muscle. He'd given up hard drinking and weed. His skin and his eyes were clear. For most of the day he manned the Crab, a powerful hoist that lifted 3,500-pound specially reinforced windows up several stories to be fixed into position. The 80-story skyscraper glistened in the sunlight, a powerful metaphor for New York City's resilience in the face of adversity. After his crew pulled in the window and he dropped the hoist down, he stole a moment to gaze north up the shores of a city that had become strangely peaceful since the dystopia of the 1990s. Every Christmas, Father's Day, and Thanksgiving, O'Malley gets up from his capacious, faded, and worn armchair to answer calls from cooperators who want to thank him. "I'm glad you chose law enforcement," SMM cooperator Dula texted him. "Not because it was for a paycheck, because we both know the money wasn't life-changing money, but because you wanted to make a difference. Very glad I met you. You saved my life." One of those calls always comes from Pipe. He figured that O'Malley had given more young men an alternative to an early grave or a lifetime of incarceration, ensuring that more children could have fathers and flourish for generations than anyone else he knew. From the moment of his first shooting at the age of 11, Pipe had been trying to gain some control, some sense of purpose and power. Sex, money, murder had looked like his best chance, but that proved illusory. Now, finally, he had a real chance to establish a safe place and a stable life without guilt or fear, but with promise. Epilogue. The streets don't love you. In December 2012, I walked into one of the proffer rooms at the U.S. Attorney's Office to meet John O'Malley. We sat and waited for Shug. A few months before, O'Malley had called me to say that he had two gang members who wanted to tell their story. "It's not bullshit stuff," said O'Malley. "These guys are the real deal." After 20 minutes, a tightly coiled figure dressed all in black, a woolen hat pulled low over his eyes, entered the room. One gold tooth glinted in the front of his mouth. "What's good, J.O.?" Shug said before turning to me and shaking my hand forcefully with his long, slender fingers. A recently inked tattoo on the back of his right hand read, "Blazin' Billy," another name for sex, money, murder. On his right was the five-pointed star of the Bloods. He took a seat at the head of the table. O'Malley told Shug to be himself and to say what was on his mind. A garbled story tumbled out, full of non sequiturs and unfamiliar names. "Niggas don't even know Pete, and they sayin' all this bullshit," he said. "They sayin' they be with him and did this and that." He had a particular scorn for a documentary in which a Blood claimed to have been with the original sex, money, murder crew. No one remembered him. And he was tired of the snitch label. People didn't understand why he had done what he'd done. O'Malley sat back and watched our interaction, chewing on the earpiece of his glasses. "I've been asked to tell my story already by a lot of people," Shug told me, alluding to a gangster-run documentary company. "That's bullshit, Shug," O'Malley said. "You sure they're not trying to set you up to get you to go down there so they can put a bullet in your head?" Shug shook his head vigorously to reject the idea. He wanted to be made a millionaire for telling his story. He wanted to move to Canada or England and start a new life. "If I ain't getting shit, why would I do it?" he fumed. O'Malley cut in again. "Look, if you're not serious, why don't you let Jonathan go on his way and stop taking up everyone's time?" "Listen, I'm happy to hear what you have to say," I said, "but I make you no promises. Either you want to tell me about your life or you don't. That's it." Finally, a smile broke across Shug's face. It seemed I'd passed the first test. "I like this guy," he said to O'Malley, clapping me on the back. O'Malley told us in no uncertain terms to be careful about how we proceeded. "Don't worry," said Shug. "I'd take a bullet for you." I later understood that if Shug felt you could better his life, he would, conditionally, go all out for you, but that much of what he said was guided by bravado and self-interest. He said there was a former OG of sex, money, murder who also wanted to meet me but didn't want to reveal himself until he got a feel for who I was. Shug would report back, and if all was good, we'd meet at an undisclosed location outside New York City. So it was that on a bleak January mid-morning in 2013, sleet lashed the hood of my old Jeep as I drove around looking for a safe haven, somewhere we wouldn't be recognized. Shug was in the back seat, talking a mile a minute, his vigorous frame bouncing from one side to the other. "If we go to Soundview, we have to take guns," he said, "and we probably shouldn't let J.O. know." He paused for a rare moment of introspection. "Oh, wait, J.O. said no guns anymore." I told Shug it wasn't necessary. "Okay," he said, "whatever you need to do to write this book. We can wear bulletproof vests, at least, J.O. says." He laughed. "I'm Gucci, yo." We pulled into a steakhouse off I-95 in Connecticut and sat down with Pipe to talk. Hunkered around a table, we laid out the story of sex, money, murder. They scrutinized my every move, my clothing, reading whatever signs they could. "Look at those boots, Skip," said Shug, pointing out my battered desert boots to Pipe.
He got some swag.
We had taken a booth out of earshot of other customers. Pipe analyzed me as Shug chattered. Pipe was laconic, unsmiling. He rolled up his sleeves to reveal beefy, heavily inked forearms. When the men discovered that my wife was Jamaican and from Brooklyn, Pipe almost choked on his food.